why things happen to people based on their own individual challenge, the nature of their individual soul, their own individual conditions in life. He said yesterday that each person has his own challenge, and conditions of that challenge don't have anything to do with whether he's a good person or a bad person, whether he's done mitzvot or done averus. If his challenge, let's say, is to deal with poverty, he's going to be poor, period. Which would mean that, for example, prayer could be useless. And take a person whose purpose in this world is to deal with poverty. When he prays for money, it just isn't going to work. Because that's what he's put here for. He's put here to sit in that condition. So, if only we knew, gosh, you know, if I get a postcard from heaven, you know, you're put here for X, and I would know, don't stop him for X, you know, it's hopeless. That's pretty determinative, that's where you're going to be. But we don't get the postcard from heaven. So we don't know. So what should we think? That some of our prayers really are useless, wrong-headed, directed in the wrong direction, because they're trying to change things that can't be changed. Could we have another understanding of what use there might be in such prayers?
Perhaps part of the trial is to actually pray for
them. Part of your trial may be to pray for the change and not get it. That may be built into the challenge. To live with it and live with the feeling that God isn't answering me in this regard, that may be a significant part of the challenge. Quite right. Quite right. Because every level-headed person knows there's no guarantee that God will answer every prayer. There's got to be reasons why He answers some and not others. You don't pray because you think you're guaranteed to get. You pray because you think there's a chance I'll get. A lot of things you do in life, you do on the basis of a chance, not on the basis of a guarantee. Someday you'll probably apply to college. There's no guarantee you'll get in. Indeed, you'll spend a lot of money applying to a lot of places knowing you're only going to one. But then you don't say, well, since I don't know I'm going to get in, why should I apply? You apply because there's a chance. Same is true with surgery. Same is true with investing your money in AT&T. There's a chance it will go up. And there's a chance it will go down. But there's a chance it'll go up. So prayer is like that. Prayer is because there's a chance. As long as you don't know what's been set for you as your particular challenge, you might just as well pray across the board. But then part of the challenge will be living with the frustration of knowing that I prayed for it and didn't get it. Quite right. Or the prayer could apply elsewhere to someone else, another condition of life. It has to be said on another occasion. I just want to make it clear that the fact that it's set doesn't mean that the prayer is useless. Now, the rest of the chapter, I'm going to go through it fairly slowly, gives lots of reasons why things happen. One reason he says is this. Not only does God judge your actions and adjust what happens to you according to your actions, but we're put in a world where actions have natural consequences. Natural according to physical nature, or natural according to certain general spiritual rules. And therefore, what happens to you today can be the result of what you did yesterday. A direct result. Mitzvah goreres mitzvah. A person does a mitzvah, thereby sets in motion a process which can bring him to another mitzvah. You know, so when you do a mitzvah, it's sort of like giving a boat a push. The boat keeps moving after you stop pushing. That's called inertia. So, or a person, you know, wastes his money on something useless, then not only is he going to be penalized for the transgression of wasting, but he's wasted his money. So the money isn't there. So one reason that something happens to a person is because of what he did previously, in a kind of mechanical fashion. Let's say a person spent the day, and at the end of the day, he does very well spiritually. He has 82 successes and 3 failures. So on the whole, I would judge him a tremendous success. But those 3 failures, by their very nature, may carry with them consequences. The fact that he had so many successes is not going to wipe out those consequences, because they're general rules by which the world runs. We have the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. The people there were wiped out. If you look at the Chazal and ask, what did they do wrong? So there are various crimes that are mentioned, but the theme seems to be that they built an anti-chesed society. No charity, no help, no support. You come here, you earn your keep. You pay your way. Why did the angels say to Lot, we'll sleep in the street? And Lot was so gracious and risked his life to take them in. The reason is because the rule in stone was, you come here and you want to stay overnight, pay for a hotel room. We're not attracting bums. People that are going to just hang around and do nothing and beg. You come here, we'll entertain tourists, pay. Want to stay here? Earn something. Work, contribute to the economy. Nobody gets to stay here for free. Now, Rasika Shalesky, under whom I had the great privilege to study for a year, 23 years ago, asked, they're being punished for setting up an anti-chesed society. Is chesed one of the laws that non-Jews have to keep? Nope. It's not there on the list. So how can they be punished for setting up an anti-chesed society? So he answered, a person who puts a blindfold on his around his eyes and strolls off a cliff, falls to the bottom, is killed, is not being punished for a transgression. He walked off a cliff. The world is built on chesed. The world was created for the sake of chesed. The first in Psalms, Olam Chesed Yibane. Setting up an anti-chesed society, he said, is like putting a plastic bubble over your city, so as to never have to worry about the weather, and forgetting to put air vents in it. Eventually, the city will asphyxiate. There will be a buildup of carbon dioxide, and will asphyxiate. Not because they're being punished, just because they created an environment in which it's impossible to survive. He said this to explain the Gemara. The Gemara says there's a certain disease which starts in the intestines and moves up to the digestive tract into the throat, and then the person dies. And the Gemara says the reason people die from this disease, called the Ascari, is because of neglecting Torah study. So the Talmud says, but women get this disease. They don't have the same obligation to study Torah as men. Yeah, because they interrupt their men, their husband's study. Non-Jews get it because they make it hard for Jews to study Torah. Children get it. You know, it says because the children interfere with their father's study of Torah. Now, asked Kuzhalevsky, but these are children. If you talk about women and non-Jews, they're adults. They're adults who can take responsibility for their actions. But children? Well, why should children get the disease? He said, the Gemara in the Dorm says, were it not for the study of Torah day and night, my world wouldn't exist. It's a law of super nature. That the creation rests on the study of Torah. Someone who interferes with the study of Torah is like putting his hand into a fire. The person who puts his hand into a fire is not being punished by getting burnt. That's the way the world is set up. So a person can perform an action that carries with it these kinds of consequences. And then what happens to him one day will be the result of what he did the previous day, irrespective of his balance of merit and demerit, good actions and bad actions. There are these general rules by which the creation runs, and they will have an effect on what happens to him. The discussed this. We said it already. We said this also in after our suffering as a means to getting someone to repent. Yes, sometimes God will use suffering to wake a person up. A certain number, it's not a majority, it's a minority, but a certain number of people become Baalei Tshuva because their lives is flowing along successfully, placidly, satisfactorily, and so they're asleep. And they keep sleeping until something wakes them up. And what wakes them up can be a very unexpected jolt. Something goes drastically wrong. Something that they never dreamt would happen. And then they begin to wonder, well, you know, so what makes the world go round? What are the dynamics? What are the forces that determine what happens? What is important? What isn't important? Later, the person looks back and says that jolt was the best thing that ever happened to him. Because otherwise he could have spent his whole life sleeping. But at the time, it's a jolt, and it forces the person to reconsider. Now he says, suffering that comes on a person to make him reconsider, rethink, and reevaluate his life is not suffering that takes, that atones, not suffering that cleanses. Cleansing is one thing, and waking up is another thing. They're two different things. So this is not punishment. Listen carefully. It's a very fine line. This is suffering that comes because of a person's failures, but it's not punishment. It comes because of his failures to wake him up. Whereas punishment has a different function. Punishment has the function of cleansing him. This won't cleanse him. The benefit will be reaped if the person pays attention to the wake-up call and does something about it. Now, in paragraph 7, he says something extremely important. What happens to a person depends in part, the in part is very important, depends in part on how he's connected to other things. What preceded him, what comes after him, who his contemporaries are, what relationships he has to them. A person is not dealt with only on the basis of what he does. So, one of the great tzaddikim of the previous generation is asked, why doesn't buy life insurance? He says, imagine, we're coming to Rosh Hashanah, and the heavenly court is judging my case. It's, look, he failed here, he failed there, he failed there. He doesn't deserve to live the next year. Along comes some defending angels and say, yeah, that may be true, but his children, do his children deserve to grow up as orphans? Do his children deserve to grow up as destitute? No. So let him live anyway for the sake of his children. He said, and then I imagine a new angel coming and saying, wait a minute, I have news. He bought life insurance. Ah, so if he dies, his children will be taken care of. No problem. Okay, bang, out he goes. That's why he doesn't buy life insurance. Okay, I'm not recommending that for everybody. A bunch of tshuva, the fine life insurance is okay. It's not a failure of piety. But what it illustrates is that how a person is judged is not just a matter of his individual life, it's a matter of how he's connected to other people. Past and future. Someone who is very great, God takes account of his greatness by treating his descendants in a certain way, perhaps differently from other people. The Talmud says that a person who's in a war zone, because he's in a place of danger, the heavenly court may look at him and say, look, you know, to save a person in a place of danger requires special treatment. Does he deserve special treatment? If he were not in a war zone, then he wouldn't need that special treatment and he wouldn't be judged that way. So, the circumstances you're in play a role in what happens to you. Not just your own individual merits or demerits. Now, 2 points. The Ramchal says explicitly that's only in this world. In the next world, you're compensated for what you did and what you tried to do. Nothing about anybody else has any role in what you get in the next world. Next world is completely just in that respect. But then the question becomes, why then in this world why then in this world isn't it the same way? Why are does divine providence take into account with connections and relationships to other people? Why wouldn't it be individual? Now, from the example I gave you, you should be already be able to answer me. Why wouldn't it be individual? Why must it take into account the relationships with other people? Because it can't work. Because it's a contradiction. If the father deserves to die and the children don't deserve to be orphaned, what are you going to do? Somebody's got to lose out. Because if the father dies because he deserves to die, then the children are going to be orphans and they don't deserve that. Often people's lives are interconnected in such a way that if one gets what he deserves, the other one definitely will not get what he deserves. So you can't pull it apart and do it, you know, one for one in that way. That's part of the reason. Yeah.
So he said the first reason why things happen is because it's a natural effect of something else that happens. So couldn't the, even though the kids don't deserve it because they don't deserve to get their father die, but maybe it's just a natural effect of their father dying, but they're not going to have a live father.
You're 100% right. You're one step behind. You're one step behind in the argument. I'm now replying to a critic. I said, what happens to you depends upon your connections to other things in the world. Which means that what you personally deserve may be overridden. That's what I said. Which is agreeing with what you said. Right? Now, I'm imagining a critic. Critic says, why? Why does it have to be that way? Why should it be taken into account on the basis of your relationship to other things? Why can't each person get just exactly what he deserves, even in this world? The answer is because people are related in such a way that, given how they're connected, if one gets what he deserves, the other one's going to not get what he deserves. He can't help it. Like the children, one's going to get what they don't deserve if the father gets what he deserves. Or the father will be preserved in a way that he doesn't deserve. For the sake of the children, I mentioned to you briefly yesterday, Rav Dessler says there are 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. One idea is the first day you're judged on the basis of your performance individually, and the second day you're judged on the basis of the extent to which the community or the world needs you. And he says explicitly, a person who fails on the first day, the basis of his own performance, the world could, his life could end. But if he has built up a gift to the world in such a way that the world depends upon him, then he can be preserved because the world needs him. Even though his own performance... Now, understand. But if the world needs him, doesn't that contribute to his performance? Yeah, it does. But it could be like, 60-40. Imagine a very, very wealthy person who's very stingy. I think it was 19, which year it was, one year they had to publish Reagan's, President Reagan, you heard of him? Ronald Reagan? Yeah, okay, good. They published his income tax returns because there was some question about his finances. That year, he earned over $1 million, speaking engagements and other things, and he gave $750 to the Cancer Foundation. That was the sum total of his charity for that year. That nobody was outraged. There were no op-ed pieces. How could the guy be so stingy? I think it's great. He gave $750. You don't have to give anything to charity. Anyway, that's the second. So now imagine a guy who's very wealthy and very stingy, but when he gives very stingy, it helps a lot. Bill Gates gives 0.01%. That's a lot of money. Now suppose he's supporting hospitals and orphans and so forth with that 0.01%. In terms of his performance, he's an absolute bum. 0.01%. But what about all those orphans who are depending upon him? So the divine providence may say, you're a bum, and considering your performance, you could drop dead. But the world needs you. The orphans need you. I don't mean this in Bill Gates particularly. I'm not just using this example. If you're the richest person in the world, you got to be used to being used as an example. Anyway. So the world could need him, even though he doesn't deserve personally to continue to exist. That's why the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. And that's part of what he means here. It could work both ways, but he was positive or negative. But now, let's try to ask a deeper question. Why is it set up like that? Why is it set up in the first place that people can get into these kinds of connections where if one person gets what he deserves, the other person won't get what he deserves, and therefore we have to sort of compromise with the conditions of this world. Why isn't the world set up in a sort of immune way, where you know, what happens to me isn't going to affect somebody else? It can always be avoided or compensated or prevented to happen. You know. I've never seen anybody raise this question, but I think there is perhaps an idea here. A crucial part of spiritual development is caring about others, caring about other people. Someone who can't empathize, who's not motivated to sympathize, he just has no concern about other people, who's so into himself and his challenges and his growth that other people don't play a role, such a person cannot, he's certainly not a spiritual success. You know, they say that a Rebbe sent his Gabbai out to check on one of his Hasidim, particularly to check on his humility. So the Gabbai came back and said to the Rebbe, Chassid is doing extremely well. He holds himself very small. It's just that he holds everybody else a little smaller. That's not humility. To say that I'm close to zero and everybody else is half of me, that's not humility. Humility has the spirituality has to have a kind of interpersonal sensitivity built into it. Now, how do I ever make that bridge? How do I ever connect with other people? What leads me originally to focus on other people? The answer is because I realize that I depend upon them and they depend upon me. I realize that without a network of relationships and cooperation, no one can exist. And I realize it from both sides, as I said 20 seconds ago. Number one, I depend upon other people. And number two, other people provide me with an opportunity to give of myself also, both of which are important to me. And then my consciousness, my mind, my sensitivity, my concern naturally spreads to include other people. If each one of us was in his own world, surrounded by cat and mice, squirrels, orangutans, and those porpoises who are cleverly chattering about digital equations in Shakespeare as they squeak along squeak along in the ocean. Some of our more loose-thinking scientist friends will tell you. If we're surrounded by that, or by robots, then there will be no room to develop concern for the other. So we're put into a world where there are real relationships, real connections, and real dependencies. What happens to me will affect him, and what happens to him will affect me. That's the prod, the motivation, the psychological bridge to develop concern and sensitivity and ultimately identification with other people. Without which, as I say, spirituality is not going to work. I think that's part of the reason for the deeper question. Now, in paragraph 8, the Rambam says something astonishing. Let's take a person who is so black. He's so black that he hasn't got a chance. He really hasn't got a chance to make it into the world to come. Says the Rambam, the highest wisdom decreed that a chance be given to him also. How? If his own performance, he's so black, he has no place there. He says, by virtue of being dependent upon somebody else. He can get in through somebody else. He can ride coattails on somebody else. Does anybody know what that means, ride coattails? There was a time when coats were split up the back, they split into two sides, they were called coattails. Imagine the guy running along, coattails is out there. So he grabs on behind, he gets going along for the ride. They can ride coattails on somebody else and get in because of somebody else. And he has a proof of it. A proof of the basis of a Kal Vachomer. There is a rule that if A can stop B from doing a transgression and does not do so, then A also will be punished for B's transgression. I don't mean stop him by necessarily tying him up or throwing a net over him, you know, or popping him on the head. But he can persuade him, or he can deprive him of the means. Something reasonable. If A can stop B from doing a transgression, then A will be punished for the transgression as well. This is a principle of punishment, of liability. That one person can be hurt by another person's actions. Now we have another rule. A rule that reward is uniformly greater than punishment. Reward is uniformly greater than punishment. Says Ramchal, he put the rules together. What you get is that since a person can be hurt by somebody else's actions, it must be what? That a person can be helped by another person's actions. Because the rule of reward is uniformly greater than that of punishment. So if punishment can come to A through B, it has to be possible that benefits can come to A through B. That's a Kal Vachomer. I never found anyone prior to Ramchal who made this Kal Vachomer, though on occasion I have found some of his statements in unexpected sources, so I can't say not. Rabbi Kaplan does not give a source for this idea. But it means, says Ramchal, that it is possible for A to have so disqualified himself by his own actions that if I look at him alone, he's not going to make it. But through B, he can make it. Now, that's all he says. He who is not worthy to enjoy the world to come because of himself, says, he who through his actions, due to his hanging on another person, who's more worthy, he too can benefit from the perfection of the world to come. He too can get it. Now, that's all he says. But he doesn't tell us how. How is it that B saves A? What does B do to save A? What kind of relationship between A and B is there that saves A on the basis of B? Could it be that B was a big tzaddik, great, righteous, holy person, prays for A, or wants A to be there, that would pull A in, even if nothing else works. I have a suggestion. Now, I must say, I've tried this out on people whom I respect, and they're not too impressed. But on the other hand, they haven't given me a good reason to give it up. So I'll mention it to you, and if I ever get something better, I'll trade it in. Let's think again about the penalty side. A could have stopped B, and he didn't. So B's crime applies to A, and A gets punished. It means that B's ability to do the crime depends upon A's non-interference. And he should have interfered. He should have done something about it. But he didn't, and that's how B got away with it. Otherwise he wouldn't have been able to do it. So A here, at least passively, is making it possible for B to do his crime. Well, let's move it over to the positive side. Suppose B is a great tzaddik, And suppose A helps B. Do it. So A becomes part of the reason that B can do this mitzvah. Not only passively, but actively. Then, maybe that kind of connection will make it possible for B's righteousness, B's holiness, to benefit A. So, here's the picture. Al Capone going out to shoot up widows and orphans and, you know, run rum and drive people into alcoholism so he can collect more money. From time to time, he says, you know, this is Benny Schwartz.
You know,
I read an article about what the Ukraine was like at the beginning of the 20th century. There was a Jewish mafia there, and they ran all sorts of illegal businesses. That was really quite a shocking article. Anyway, so he's, you know, he's running these things, the smuggling rings and extortion, and from time to time, he sends a donation to the local Hasidic Rebbe. Listen, pulled in 10 million rubles this year, send them 1,000. Ah, look at that! He sent 1,000 rubles to the rabbi. Okay, we'll let him in on the coattails of the rabbi. Now, if I put it that way, it sounds pretty thin. It sounds like conscious money, you know. It's just, you know. But we could possibly explain it. Again, this is all my stuff, so I don't know how much weight to put on it. Chazal say, based on Sukkim, that wicked people hate good people. They hate righteous people. Sof Rosh HaLatanik Mavakesh Hamito. The wicked person observes the righteous person and wants to kill him. Why? Because the righteous person is a continuous reminder of what the wicked person is not and ought to be. He's a conscience. The wicked person looks at the righteous person and says, I can't live with peace and happiness and security as long as that guy is there giving a picture of what I ought to be and what I'm not. So, Chazal say, and the pasuk says, the wicked person wants to kill the righteous person. He wants to kill him. He wants him out of his world. Now, this Benny Schwartz in the Ukraine, who's running his extortion ring and his smuggling ring and all the rest of it, sent the 1,000 rubles to the rabbi. 1,000 rubles to the rabbi. Why does he do that? Why doesn't the rule that the wicked person hates the righteous person and wants to kill him fit? Must be that Benny Schwartz
isn't wholly wicked.
That's it. Good for you. He isn't wholly wicked. If he were wholly wicked, he would use the 1,000 rubles to pay somebody to burn down the Rebbe's house. He wouldn't send it down as a contribution. So something in Benny Schwartz still can respond to Kedusha, to holiness. Can respond to righteousness. There's something in him that says, I want to be connected to that too. Keep kosher? Listen, don't talk to me about cheeseburgers. That's too much. But still, I don't want to be totally happy. I want to be connected also. And that could be the key to saying that he isn't really totally wicked. But that's as a mitzvah, it's not enough. As a mitzvah, it's not enough. Just that he gave 1,000 rubles to charity against all the other terrible things that he did? No. But now that he wants to be connected to this righteous person's righteousness and holiness can benefit him as well. And he could be pulled into the world to come on the coattails of that righteous person. What's that?
He's not speaking about that. He's speaking about that the person is hope. There's here, there's a connection between that and that he did the relationship is that he did something good, which maybe by itself wouldn't be enough to take him in. Right? But who says that's what the Ramchal is speaking about? He just says based on somebody else. He goes in. Here, you would think by saying that the other person has done nothing good at all. That's what you would think. To say he did something, that's not enough, therefore the connection is.
You are innocent of reading the book, but let's read the book together. We'll see whether that's what the Ramchal's words say or whether they're not. In addition to all the above, there's another idea, principle, which is the highest wisdom observes everything that's appropriate to exist in order to perfect the species and to make the gathering of the perfected that we've mentioned above, and saw, the highest wisdom saw, that it would be very appropriate for this goal, that there would be the ability of some to benefit others and to be of use and benefit to others. Perush, explanation. It shouldn't be an absolute rule that only he who, by virtue of his own strength, shall achieve perfection and be among those in the perfected community of the world to come. It shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that only those who by their own strength are worthy should go in. No. Rather, even he, also he, whose own actions will qualify him to be connected, hanging on another one, greater than he. I should use these words against my critics. This is really pretty good, actually. Even a person whose actions qualify him, push him, put him in a position that he's connected to someone else who's greater than he, that he also should be able to benefit from perfection. And he also should go into that community of the perfected of the world to come. Only he should be on the very low level. The level of one who doesn't get in on the basis of his own actions, but gets in on the basis of being, of hanging on somebody else. And that way, he will not be totally pushed off of perfection. Or rather say, that way, the only one who will be totally pushed off of perfection is one whose own actions don't qualify him to get in, and also his actions don't qualify him to be dependent on somebody else who could get him in. So there's an extra way to get in. He doesn't say he's totally black. All he says is his actions by themselves don't qualify him to get in. He's already said prior to this, a person whose actions don't qualify him to get in could have some good deeds, and those good deeds are paid off here in this world, and that's why wicked people benefit in this world. Not totally black. But there's something called your actions qualifying you to be connected or dependent upon somebody else, hanging somebody else. And then you can benefit. But it does seem like your actions have to do it. What? Now, what actions would it be that qualify you to be hanging at somebody else, even if your own actions by themselves don't get you into the world to come?
Why is it necessary? If I've done an action, why is that little man kind of necessary? You could say, I'm not enough to get to a certain level. Why am I going to say, no, I'm not enough by myself, I'm enough to connect to that and take me to that level? What's the little man doing?
I'll give you an example, but if this doesn't do it, I don't know how to do it. Let's take two people. Each person is 10,000 bad and 3 good. Okay? Person A and person B. Person A, in his 10,000 bad or terrible, terrible crimes, and his 3 good are, he once relieved the suffering of an animal, and he once resisted eating a cheeseburger, and he once stabbed a minstrel. Okay? Those are his 3 good. And B has a 10,000 bad with the same list of terrible crimes. And the 3 good are, he 3 times gave money to a tzaddik. Now it's 10,000 to 3. So if I ask for the score, the same score in both cases. And if the score of achievement and crime is going to be the determinant, they're both going to be pushed off. But B used his 3 good ones to connect himself to a tzaddik. That quality of the action alone changes his thing. Why? Because I have a rule that people's lives affect one another. In particular, I have a rule that A can be hurt by B's actions. A can be hurt by B's actions. If A can be hurt by B's actions, A has to be able to be benefited by B's actions. That's a kavachomer. Now, what kind of relationship is it when A gets hurt by B? It's because A was involved in one way or another. He was involved because he should have stopped B from doing this.
raises the level of his actual personal achievement in those three.
No, no, it doesn't show. That, why
they, they, in terms of effort of those three things, they were both the same.
Correct.
Get in,
correct. Correct. That's right. And a person who's going to get in on his own level will not get more credit for the one than the other. A person who's 50-50 and has these three and those three to his credit, those three will earn him an equal reward. That doesn't have to be individually more significant. But in this case, the very fact that it connects him to the other person gives him an advantage, not because of its size, not because of its effort, but because of its particular definition, because of a particular subject. Well, let me deal with rules here. That's very important. Justice is only important when you're talking about punishment. Not when you're talking about reward. You don't complain that a person got too much reward because that was unjust. Here we're talking about a person whose personal score should lead him to be lost altogether, and unexpectedly he's getting in. And say, well, that's unjust. Right? Justice is only a complaint on the negative side, never on the positive side. If you get a bonus, you get a bonus in your job, you're not going to say, I'm sorry, it's unjust, you know, that wasn't in the contract.
So the answer really is, who knows, but it's definitely not unjust.
Who knows what?
Who knows why it works this way?
Well, he gave you okay. Here, there's a subtle point. He gave you a proof. Now, I agree with you. This, if you don't understand this immediately, you can think about it. It's a pretty deep point in intellectual studies of all kinds. There's a big difference between a proof and an explanation. Very often in life, you get a proof. You say, okay, I found it. I see the argument. It definitely holds. It's true. But why is it true? I have no doubt that it is true. But why? In mathematics, you sometimes get messy proofs. Lots and lots of different cases, and each case is treated a different way. And you go through it, it takes you an hour, and you say, well, gosh, you know, I guess it's right, but I don't have a clue as to why it's right. Sometimes you have proofs that mathematicians call beautiful. I know that sounds crazy, but having experienced it, there are proofs that are beautiful. They show you the guts of what's going on. They explain to you, you know, how it works. When I talk to some of you about quantum mechanics, you know, there's a situation where I can prove to you what's happening, but I can't explain to you how it's happening, or why it's happening. So here, I agree with you in a way. What we got is a proof that it must be so. And I have a motivation. God wants as many people as possible to make it in. But exactly why this works in the way that it does, I can't say more than that. I agree with you. I would like more understanding myself. But a proof, he definitely has. And he gives you an opportunity now. Just in case you don't know the history, Ramchal was not part of the Hasidic movement. But it does sound like a reasonably Hasidic idea, huh? Hasidim stressed their being a tzaddik. The Rebbe is supposed to play the role of tzaddik, not Rosh Yeshiva, not Posek, but tzaddik. And it's very important for every Chosid to have a connection with him. And they do say things like, you know, when all else fails, he'll get me in. Well, now that I think of it, isn't there a statement in the Talmud that Abraham stands at the entrance to Gehenna, and for every Jew who is circumcised, you know, he sort of stands there and protects him? That's Abraham, the great Rebbe, right? The greatest Rebbe of all. Okay. I'm just playing. Yeah, now... I'll try to do this quick, but I don't have to do it tomorrow. Let's say, today's Wednesday, I have to do tomorrow again. There is such an idea that a person's suffering could count beyond himself. We have a statement in Chazal, under certain conditions, certain times, a decree may be made against the whole generation or a whole community, and if the tzaddik suffers, then the decree could be taken off the community. Either a tzaddik could suffer, or even sometimes when a tzaddik dies, for his community, for the generation, and even, sometimes, more extravagantly, even for the whole world. The residue of pollution from the failure of Adam and Chava, man and Eve, that too has to be rectified. How does it work? Well, here's George suffering. Gosh, why is George suffering? Could be, I would say, in the vast majority of cases, George is suffering because of George. either because he did something wrong and it's being punished, or he did something wrong and the suffering is to wake him up to try to do tshuva, or because this is his lot in life to conquer this particular piece of perfection, and to do that involves this suffering. Could be that George is suffering just because of George himself. But let's imagine a person who's very great, who's conquered already great things, who's achieved levels of perfection that are very outstanding. In terms of his life alone, he might deserve very little suffering. If he gets more than his measure, then it counts as surplus. It's surplus suffering. Surplus suffering can count towards something else. It can count towards the community, it can count towards the generation, or it can count even towards removing that pollution from the world as a whole. Alright, I can't explain why this is, but I'll just give you a little mathematical result and we've got to quit. Now, imagine a person who's so great that the surplus suffering he has counts towards someone else, something else, the community, the world. Isn't that a great thing to do? To suffer for them? That's a really great thing to do. Which means that if he accepts that surplus suffering and dedicates it to purifying or protecting community, the generation, the world, that makes him into an even greater tzaddik. Aha. But an even greater tzaddik deserves even less suffering. Which means that the amount of suffering that he has turns into a bigger surplus. And since it's a bigger surplus, he's even a greater tzaddik, which then reduces the amount of suffering that he deserves, which makes it a bigger surplus. You have a kind of progression here of greater and greater merit. So in other words, let's suppose he deserves 20 suffering, right? And he's got 40. And he dedicates the other 20 to helping others. That's a big thing to do. Makes him a bigger tzaddik. And now he only deserves 15. Which means that out of the 40, 25 is surplus. And he accepts the whole 25 as surplus and dedicates it. That's even a bigger thing to do. So now he's a bigger tzaddik and only deserves 10. If he only deserves 10, then 30 is surplus. Right? So he's got more surplus, and so he can convert it to higher and higher levels of impact on the world. That's a progression that the Ramchal mentioned in this paragraph. Okay, well, I think this is